Ian Carmichael now reads the fourth of our five morning stories by A.J. Allen. It's called A Joyride.
At the beginning of this last September, I was spending a long weekend with some friends of mine who live near Ascot. He's a member of a big firm of underwriters. Not that it matters in the least what he does for a living, but I just mention it. And in case you don't know what an underwriter is, you've only to look at the end of your insurance policy, and you'll find a list of seven names applied with a rubber stamp. Those are underwriters, and they are the unfortunate individuals who have to fork out when you make a claim. Incidentally, I can't help thinking that on occasions like the 5th of November, underwriters must feel rather overwrought. All the same, I must admit that my friend seems to thrive on taking these appalling risks. I've called it a long weekend because I was staying till Tuesday morning. Well, after we'd gone up to bed on the Monday night, I saw a glare in the sky and actual smoke and flames appearing over some trees about half a mile off. I felt a bit of a brute, but I went along to my host's room and said, "I hate to talk shop, but there is a perfectly good house on fire functioning quite close to. Don't you think something ought to be done about it?" Well, he came dashing back to my room and looked out of the window, and then he said, "Lord, that must be the Stimpsons. We shall have to go along and help." So we flung on some suitable garments and started off for this place. It never does to go empty-handed to a fire in the country, so we took a ladder with us. Well, by the time we arrived on the scene, they'd given up trying to put the fire out as a bad job. There wasn't any water. They were merely trying to save what furniture and so on that they could. The lawn was already strewn with a somewhat embarrassing array of one thing and another, and as the staircases had both gone, we propped up our ladder against the first-floor window and carried on the good work till the roof fell in. After that, we left the various fire brigades and took the inmates of the house back to our place and put them up as best we could. We all turned out of our rooms, but I don't think anyone actually went to bed. There was a ghastly meal of sandwiches and coffee at about 6, and after that I bagged the bathroom and got clean. Then, after breakfast, we went and inspected the ruins of the house, and such of us as had to came up to town. I turned up at my office with the full intention of taking the afternoon off, but when I got there, there was what they call a flap on. You know, a panic. It was about something quite futile, panics usually are, but it meant everyone staying till it was over. I didn't get home till after 7, by which time I was dead to the world. I don't know about you, but I simply cannot do without sleep indefinitely. The trouble was that they were expecting me here at the BBC at 10:15 to read one of these stories. Well, I changed and had a light dinner at home and slept solidly all the way here. They were awfully good to me when I arrived. They plied me with strong black coffee up in the canteen and kept me going just long enough to tell my story. And then I fell asleep in front of the microphone. Colonel Brand looked in and shook me and said, "If you don't mind waiting a few minutes, I'll give you a lift home." Apparently there was a party of people whom he was going to drop on the way, but they weren't quite ready. They were being shown the control room first. Well, presently he came along with these people and we all piled into his car. It was a bit of a squash as we were 7 up, so I sat on the floor and leant back against the knees of some young woman. I'm sure she was delightful, but her knees were very bony. They very nearly kept me awake. The next thing I remember was our driving into the courtyard of Queen Anne's Mansions. There are several entrances to the flats round this courtyard, and we stopped at the one in the middle of the right-hand side. We all got out, and then there was a discussion. These good souls wanted us to go up to their flat and have a drink, and Colonel Brand said that he would, and I was just beginning to say I was afraid I couldn't stop, when the hall porter chipped in and said the car couldn't stop where it was. If it was going to be left for any length of time, it would have to be parked in the middle of the quad by the fountain. So our five friends went inside, leaving Colonel Brand and me on the pavement. Now, I want to make this bit quite clear, if you don't mind. He moved the car out into the middle. There were several others there, all in a row. And then he came back and said, "Do come up just for a few minutes. It's only 11:15. I said, "Don't think me awfully ungracious, but I'm really not in a fit state. Make my apologies to Mrs. What's-her-name, and for pity's sake let me go on sleeping." So he said, "All right," and went in. And I went across and got into the car. It was a bit public there, so in order not to look too much like an exhibit in a glass case, instead of sitting on the seat, I arranged myself in my old position. That is to say, on the floor, leaning back against the seat, and I closed my eyes once more. Well, I don't know how long I slept, but the next thing I was aware of was that we were no longer standing still. We were proceeding along the road at a rate of knots. Well, this didn't worry me, of course, because it only meant that Colonel Brown had started up without calling me and was running me home. But when we shot across Putney Bridge, it was clear that there was something wrong somewhere. Well, I raised myself up a few inches and took a cautious look forward. Well, that did give me a surprise, if you like, because it wasn't Colonel Brown driving. It was a much smaller man in a bowler hat. Well, it didn't take me very long to realize that this cove, whoever he was, had walked in and stolen the car without noticing that he'd got me too, and I wished him joy of me. The question was how best to deal with the situation, and I came to the conclusion that it would be wisest to sit tight and see where we went. As you probably know, it's the receivers of stolen cars who are the important people to catch. Well, I huddled down as much out of sight as possible and did my utmost not to doze off. But I'm afraid I must have done, because I found some time later we'd left the main road without my knowledge and were going through a whole lot of narrow country lanes. Finally, after a good long time, on the way up a big hill, we turned in at some gates and stopped. My friend got down, opened the doors of a garage, turned the car round, backed it in, switched off the lights, and locked up. Well, as soon as his footstep had died away, I got out of the car and had a feel round. The garage doors were firmly padlocked on the outside, but that wasn't very serious, because the staples the padlock was fastened to were bolted through the doors, with nuts of these bolts on the inside. All one had to do was undo the nuts with a spanner and emerge, which I did. On my left, as I came out, I could just distinguish the shape of a medium-sized house, which clearly belonged to the garage, and I took enough particulars of that house to be able to know it again. There was a light in one of the ground-floor windows, but the curtains were drawn and one couldn't see in. However, I had found the place, and it couldn't run away, so that was all right. I didn't see the fun of hanging about all night, and I was determined that Branch would have his car back, whatever happened, and it was my only means of getting back to London, so it seemed wisest to make certain of the car first. I went back to the garage and shoved it out. Fortunately, the little bit of drive sloped down to the gates, and the road outside was downhill too, so I was able to get in and run something like 300 yards without starting the engine or making any noise. I pulled up at the side of the road and thought some more, and the more I thought, the more I jibbed at the idea of going away without being able to identify the man. It seems so feeble, and while I don't mind doing anything wrong, within reason, I'm blowed if I'll do anything feeble. Well, there were still lights on downstairs. The man himself opened the door, and the moment I saw him, I began to have my first doubts as to whether there mightn't have been a mistake somewhere. He didn't look at all the sort of person you would expect to steal motor cars. He was between 45 and 50, and most friendly. He never asked me what I wanted. He simply said, "Glory be, can you draw a cork?" I said, "Can I draw a cork? Well, of course I can. Don't be ridiculous. Why?" Then he told me. He said, "We're in a dreadful predicament. I've made £5,000 in the city today. We've only one bottle of whiskey worthy of the occasion, and I've got a sprained wrist, and I can't trust my wife." I said, "Well, I'm sorry you can't trust your wife, but have you tried knocking the neck off the bottle?" He said, "My dear man, it is 90 years old. Come along." And he took me through into a little smoking room where he introduced me to his wife. She was an extremely charming woman in a negligee that made even me blink. It fairly took the cake for negligence. We said, "How do you do?" Next, they introduced me to the bottle with the cork which refused to be drawn, but it didn't persist in its refusal for very long. When he was safely out, we all had some of this gorgeous stuff in liqueur glasses. Do you know, it was impossible to tell it from the finest old brandy. It was like milk. No, better than milk. We sort of sat and chatted, and they gave me my position, which, by the way, was 6 miles from Guildford, so I must have just nodded off a bit on the way down. Well, time went on, and I was wondering how on earth to introduce the subject of his being a thief without striking too discordant a note, when my eye was caught by an engraving of the Close at Rugby hanging on the wall. He saw me looking at it, and he said, "Were you there by any chance?" And I said, "Yes." Then he asked me what house I was in, and I told him, and he said, "Whitelaw's? Were you in Whitelaw's? So was I." "That means we shall have to have another." Oh, quite inevitable, of course. Actually, it meant more than that. It meant I couldn't run him in, whatever he'd done. Anyway, he poured out another modicum all round of this priceless liquid, and we went on swapping lies about the Bodger and Puff and Bull and various other people who are now either bishops or angels, until I suddenly caught sight of the time. 1:30. I jumped up to go, but first they wouldn't hear of it. Why not stay the night and go up to London in the morning? Well, you've no idea how difficult it was to get away. It was even more difficult to prevent them walking down to the car with me, and that really would have been awkward. We continued to swear undying friendship until we were too far apart to shout, me feeling no end of a hypocrite, mind you. But when I was safely out of earshot, I broke into a brisk trot, because any minute they might have noticed that the garage doors were open. I found the car all right and started back to London. Well, there was a small village about a mile further on, and halfway along the main street there was a police station. Just as I was getting to it, a policeman ran out bang in front of me. He was the largest and fattest policeman I ever saw. He was trying to do up his belt as he ran, and it wouldn't meet, and he scuttled along in the glare of my headlights, dodging from side to side, just as rabbits sometimes do. I had to pull up to avoid running over him, and he asked me if I was going past Bolton's Corner. I hadn't the faintest idea, of course, but I offered to drive him there if he'd show me the way. And he got in, and the car promptly developed a heavy list. On the way along, I asked him, "What's the trouble at Bolton's Corner?" And he explained that some people had broken into a garage and stolen a motor car, and the police were out all over the shop blocking the roads. One of the places where they were shoving up a barrier was this Bolton's Corner, where we were going to. Well, this looked cheerful. I worked it out that it couldn't be me they were after, because there'd hardly been time. But in any case, it would mean my being held up for goodness knows how long, and asked a whole lot of silly questions. Well, presently we arrived at this place and found an inspector and two constables very industriously rigging up a barricade of scaffold poles. We stopped and got out, and the inspector came up and thanked me very civilly for having given his man a lift. He clearly recognised I was respectable and all that, but his instructions were to let no one through. I said, "Well, that's all right, Inspector. Of course you've got to obey orders, and I like your barrier. But are you quite sure you have chosen the best place for it?" And I took him back to a little bridge I'd just crossed and said, "There now, that's lovely and narrow. You could hold it against an army." He quite agreed, and they took down their poles and things from in front of me and solemnly carted them back to this bridge behind me, which only goes to show that there are more ways than one of passing a barrier. I didn't wait to see what sort of a job they made of it, because I was beginning to feel sleepy again. In fact, my recollections of driving up to town are distinctly hazy, but I got there somehow or other. I even managed to park the car with meticulous care in the exact position it had been taken from in Queen Anne's Mansions courtyard. My first really clear impression was standing on the running board and comparing my wristwatch with the clock on the dash. They both apparently stopped at 11:30. I thought, that's funny. And I walked across to the hall porter and asked him what the time was, and he said, 11:30.